hadn't been recorded yet. We're on Zionism, part two. Everybody agrees that the land itself is invested with holiness. That's why there's all of these anti-Zionist religious Jews in Israel, because they want to be there in the land. There's only certain mitzvahs you could perform in Israel. And every four paces you walk in Israel is like a mitzvah. God is more in Israel. The Ramban, that Penina, who just spoke so beautifully in the other room, Nachmanides, that same Nachmanides says that like keeping mitzvahs outside of Israel is nice, but it's not the same as keeping a mitzvah in Israel. My rabbi, Rabbi Grimblatt, used to call it like batting practice. It's like you can warm up in the pen, you know, but those points don't count as much, right? That's why you go to a gym. You can work out anywhere, but the working out in a gym is a little more conducive. So everybody holds the land. But what about the government? Why would Rav Kook, who was as religious as Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, who was anti, why would he go along with the Zionists then? Why would he side with them? Why would he back them, support them, pray for them?
Because it's the beginning of redemption.
Because he thought, this is it. He didn't say this was the Mashiach. Nobody claims Ben-Gurion was the Messiah, but he thought it was what? Not the Mashiach, but the what? Is there just no Mashiach, exile, and yes Mashiach? Is there anything in the middle? Phases, a progression, a development. What we call in Hebrew, atchalta, which is Aramaic for lehatchil, the beginning of ge'ula. What's ge'ula? It's a very religious section in Jerusalem, but it also means redemption. Atchalta de'ula, we are living, and that's what Rabbi Kook believed. He said, we have not seen the Mashiach, but to say we're not living in messianic times, in times that are leading up to the Mashiach. And who's bringing the Mashiach? Anyone who brings us back to Israel is bringing the Mashiach. Now, anyone who keeps a mitzvah is also bringing the Mashiach. Okay, you can take the Chabad route. You know, Mashiach, now, I don't know if you saw that route. You saw that video going around on CBS? Shosha's not here. And there's a new flag. It must be a new country. It's called Moshiach. You know, the guy, some Chabad guy was waving a Mashiach flag at a Hamas, you know, pro-Palestinian thing. So he held that what? He held that it's coming. It's bringing the Mashiach. Which is why, by the way, the Rav Kooknicks, those who follow Rav Kook, were the ones that were the most against land transfers for quote-unquote peace. Now, you guys may be too young for this, but I got a little involved in the Oslo Accords when I was younger, in the early 90s. You guys heard of the Oslo Accords? They were an attempt. Welcome, Shosh. They were an attempt to make peace with the Palestinians in a very serious way. It was basically during the Clinton era, the Bill Clinton times. We came very close signing a peace treaty on the lawn of the White House. Between Yasser Arafat, who was a terrible, terrible person and fooled a lot of people, including Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton said to him, and it was quoted, "You made me a failure." Because he devoted his entire administration to making peace. Yeah, okay, there was other stuff too. I like Bill Clinton. Yeah, I know. Okay, all that stuff. I know, he should have owned up, but okay, whatever. But who was against it? In the religious Jewish community, who was against the Oslo Accords?
The Rebbe.
The Lubavitcher Rebbe was for other reasons. But anyone who was against giving back land. Now, what was Rav Salvechik's view on that? Rav Salvechik was also a very solid Zionist, so much so that he broke with his own family tradition, and he left a rabbinic association called the Agudas HaRabbanim of America. And it's actually international, but it's all over the world. His father, Rav Moshe Salvechik, his grandfather, Rav Chaim Salvechik, were leaders in the Aguda. He broke with the Aguda and he joined the Mizrahi, which is the modern Orthodox group, over this issue. But he was not opposed to land transfers if it could bring peace. Salvechik was once quoted as saying that you can give back the Kotel if it will bring peace. Don't ask me, he said, if it will. I'm not a political expert. I'm not a military strategist. I'm not a diplomat. Go speak to the experts. But if they think it could make peace, then give back whatever you need to give back. The Lubavitcher Rebbe did not agree with that, and Rav Kook did not. And a lot of the hardened, little more right-wing, I guess we would call more right-wing groups that are settling Yehuda v'Shomron, Judea and Samaria, were the Rav Kooknicks. Rav Kook's son was Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. He's not alive anymore either. He was a great teacher. His school is called Merkaz. My kids have friends who are in Merkaz now. It's like a big religious Zionist school. And they're like really like hardcore. And they're like going into the army is like the biggest mitzvah in the world. Has anyone seen like they just went into Rafa? Has anyone seen like these like a soldier getting in the middle of a circle? And then like there's like 80 soldiers around. And he's given like this pep talk. And he's like, everyone's saying, Amen, Amen, Amen. And not everyone's wearing kippot. And you see guys, I did this when I was on an Israeli army base. I made a bracha for them. And right away I see Israeli soldiers. They take their hand, they put it on someone else's head. This guy puts it on. It's actually very cool. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if it works or where they got it from. You're really supposed to have a kippah, whatever. But they like, this is like their pep talk going into war, basically. Who do you think is at the core of these pep talks? It's these Rav Kooknit guys. They're like passionate. You know, now the other wing of religious Zionism, also very passionate, but they were a little more moderate because they're not as messianic in their approach, and that's the Rav Soloveitchik students and followers, my teachers, who are very pro-Israel, pro the government, pro the army, pro all these things. Even though the people who started it were not religious, and even though the government does not follow halacha, and even though all of these things, why? What was Rav Soloveitchik's reason? So that's what I want to jump in with you tonight. Turn to your packet. It's a page. I just want to read one thing. It's page 3 on your packet. There you go. Anybody have? Page 3 on the packet. Rav Soloveitchik wrote a gorgeous treatise. And you can get it. It's in English. It's called Fate and Destiny. I want to thank my friend, my cousin, Moshe Sokolow, who's a great scholar, for summarizing the 6 knocks of religious Zionist opportunity. Okay, we're going to run through all 6. This is written by Rabbi Soloveitchik. But before you look down, I want to give you the context. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote almost like a poet. And he took a piece of Shir HaShirim, and he used it to describe his view of religious Zionism. Anybody know what Shir HaShirim is?
Yeah.
Song of Songs. Who wrote it? King Solomon. About? Anybody know what it's about? God and the Jewish people, the relationship. But he used what was the metaphor running throughout the book. It's beautiful. It's poetry. It's love poetry. They said he wrote it when he was younger, that he wrote Ecclesiastes, which is very kind of like more dark when he was older, more philosophical and not so, there's a time for this, there's a time for that. That's in Ecclesiastes. Shir Shirim is like one big love poem. And there's this one scene where this man and this woman who are in sort of enraptured and very passionate love relationship, and the trust is broken, they break up. And it's like awful. And the man is trying to get the woman to come back to him. And she's lying on her bed crying, and he's banging at the door. And she's yelling, "Leave me alone." These are the words in the Torah. It's the part of the canonized Bible in Tanakh. And the woman says, "I'm already undressed." You know, which is like, I'm already in bed. I'm not coming back. I can't do this anymore. I'm too hurt. And the man is, and it says, and the words are, Kol dodi dofek. Behold, my beloved is knocking. And she's saying, my beloved is, and like, and she can't do it. And then finally he gives up. And then he leaves. And then she comes to her senses and she gets out of bed. She opens the door and he's not there. She starts running through the streets. And like a crazy person, she starts, has anyone seen my lover? Where is my lover? Has anyone seen my lover? And Rabbi Soloveitchik took that very vivid imagery, and he said, that's God and the Jewish people. The Holocaust, there it is, thank you. You're the man. Kol dodi dofek, behold my beloved is knocking. It's translated into English. He wrote it in Hebrew. It's gorgeous. And it's basically his treatise on why bad things happen to good people. And within the context of talking about bad things happen to good people, he talks about the Holocaust. And while he's talking about the Holocaust, he then talks about the birth of the state of Israel. And he says, basically, the Jewish people are like the woman lying in the bed crying. God is like the man knocking at the door. And we're sort of licking our wounds, and we're hurt, and we're damaged after the Shoah, and we're just crying, and behold, my beloved is knocking. God is knocking on the door. How? What's the knock? The knock is the state of Israel, for the Rav. And he puts this in sort of theological terms, because people were trying to make theological sense out of, and he says that there were basically six knocks. And I want to run through the six knocks with you. And each of these knocks, to be perfectly honest, is like very inspiring to me. It sort of fills me with my own, why I love Israel so much and what Israel means to me, and or the founding of Israel. You know, it doesn't even get to how beautiful and how amazing Israel is for its own self, but this is just the way it started. Picture, Rabbi Soloveitchik. I think he wrote this in the 1950s, and it was basically speeches and writings that he authored to get American Jews to support Israel, and to get religious American Jews and throughout the world to support Israel, and not be put off by all of the things that were keeping a lot of other Orthodox Jews from supporting what he called in Hebrew the Yishuv, which was the settlement in Israel. Follow with me. This is just a paraphrase. I could read it to you in the original, but it's going to take longer. And this is just cuts to the chase of what each one is. But you can get this book. You should get it. It's really worthwhile. First, the knock of opportunity was heard in the political arena. No one can deny that from the standpoint of international relations, the establishment of the state of Israel in a political sense was almost supernatural. Anybody know what he's referring to? What was supernatural in the United Nations?
That was like the only time all the nations...
All the nations voted in favor. Now, yeah. You'll say, what do you mean? It was 3 years after the Holocaust. What, the world didn't feel a little bad for us? You know, I always had a hard time. Like, of course, why is it such a big deal that we got a majority vote in favor of partition? But look now, we're 6 months since October 7th. Does the world feel bad for us? You don't say, oh, this is more complicated. The Holocaust was simpler. I mean, I when I spoke with Maritza, Mrs. Shelley, the woman who spoke here, I thanked her for coming. She goes, thank you so much. I'm so happy I get to talk to such a big group of young people. I'm looking for more and more opportunities to do that. Mm. She doesn't feel, and this is true, that enough people really know the details. And when you don't know the details of something, you kind of like doubt it a little. And anybody know like a little almost supernatural occurrence that took place in the vote in the UN, which is kind of important? What's that? The United States voted in favor. Everyone's like, that's not a big deal. It was a huge deal. Who was the president?
Truman
was a bit of an anti-Semite himself. And we have recordings of things he said, even though one of his best friends was a Jew who actually saved the whole thing. I'll tell you in a minute. But Truman was being heavily influenced by the State Department to vote against partition in the UN. Why? Same reason as today. Oil. The United States was getting a lot of its oil imports from the Arab world, and they didn't want partition. The Arabs were very against partition because it meant giving the Jews even a tiny little piece of Israel. They didn't want that. How did they get Truman to vote in favor?
Business
Eddie Jacobson.
Yeah.
It's a simple haberdasher from Kansas City. It's a crazy story. They went to Kansas City and they found him. And they said, we know that Harry Truman listens to you. They were business partners. They had a clothing store. And this is, by the way, big Kiddush Hashem. I used to speak about my Zaidi. I put this in my first book about how honest he was and how his honesty really developed such a Kiddush Hashem. But the same thing, Harry Truman has such respect for Eddie Jacobson because he was so honest. And he traveled to Washington. He picked up a little statue on Harry Truman's desk. He said, of Andrew Jackson, he said, Harry, I know this is your, Andrew Jackson is your hero. I also have a hero. He's very old. And he's a great chemist from England. His name was Chaim Weizmann. And he traveled 6,000 miles to meet with you. He's old and he's sick, and I'm begging you, please give him an audience. And he did. Chaim Weizmann, by the way, you know who Chaim Weizmann was?
Weizmann,
he was a chemist who developed a detonating device for the British during World War I. He helped bring about the Balfour Declaration, which was the first acknowledgement on the part of the Western nations of the world that Israel has a right to its own homeland. And he convinced Jacobson. And he got a meeting with Harry Truman. Nobody knows what happened in the meeting, but Truman voted in favor of partition. Yeah. Another miracle. Who also voted in favor of partition?
Russia.
Stalin. You guys ever heard of Joseph Stalin, who ruthlessly persecuted Jews and Zionists in the former Soviet Union for decades, voted in favor of partition, and brought along with him the entire Soviet bloc, which could not have passed without the Soviets. There was all sorts of weird political machinations. I assure you they didn't do it because they loved Jews. But somehow they got a vote in favor, and we had a state. Very important to know in terms of what you're seeing on campus today. You know, does Israel really not believe in a two-state solution? It's not just Israel. The world came up with the idea of a two-state solution. It wasn't Israel's idea. It was the United Nations' idea to deal with the British when they left the mandate. They were Arabs and Jews. Let's split it up. How did the Jews react?
Said, okay, fine.
Dancing the hora in the streets of Tel Aviv. You can get a video. You can put on YouTube and you'll see Jews dancing the hora. It's very awkward. We're not good dancers. But you can see the Jews dancing. And the Arabs to this day call it the Nakba, which is like I don't even know what the word means. Anybody know what the word Nakba means? It's not a good word.
Disaster. Right?
It's like a disaster or something. I mean, they were offered a state, by the way, because there was no state there. There was just Transjordan and a lot of lands. So that was one. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, don't take that for granted. That's God knocking on our door, that the nations of the world voted in favor of partition. Two, the knocking of the beloved could be heard on the battlefield. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty Arab armies. The miracle of the many in the hands of the few. Anybody know what that quote's from? The miracle of the many in the hands of the few. Hanukkah, very good. Rabim biyad me'atim. It's from the Hanukkah story. And it's kind of a Hanukkah story. Anybody know how many Jews were fighting? About 55,000 Jews that were fighting against 5 to 6 Arab armies that had like tanks, air forces. The Jews didn't have there was no air force in Milchemet HaShukra. They were giving guns that were being smuggled in from Czechoslovakia. I know this because there was a rabbi in 91st Street, the Dvorhan Shtibel, and he was a rabbi in Prague, and he spent the war smuggling the Hasidic Rebbe. And by the way, all this stuff about Jews being anti, when it comes down to it, Jews help each other. Hasidic Rebbe, probably an anti-Zionist, was sending guns to Israel. Okay, and that was not uncommon. And because he was very well connected. His son, Rabbi Vorhan, is the Shtibel. You know Rabbi Vorhan? He's 91st between West End and Riverside. So I had the zechus of knowing his father. His father died many years ago. And they were giving guns to Holocaust survivors who were being smuggled in on ships. And by the way, some of those ships were coming from they were U.S. merchant marine ships that young Jews in America who served in the Second World War were smuggling in boats and to get Jews out of DP camps after the war into Israel. And the British were still putting them in if you can go to Atlit. Atlit is, we used to start our trip off in Atlit. A lot of Jews who were in concentration camps were put by the British in Atlit. They eventually were taken out, but they were basically in camps in Israel, on the water. Anyway, so we won. The day after Israel declared her independence, Ben-Gurion declared independence, 5 Arab armies descended on this ragged band of Holocaust survivors. And we won. We fought for a month. Milchemet HaShichrur, the Shachrer means to emancipate, the war of emancipation of independence. And a month later, we had a state. That was another miracle. That's another knock, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. Look at 3. Theological. This is very interesting. The beloved began to knock on the door of the theological tent. And it may very well be that this is the strongest knock of all, even though he says that about 2 different knocks, but whatever. All the claims of Christian theologians that God deprived the Jewish people of its rights in the land of Israel, and that all the biblical promises regarding Zion and Jerusalem refer allegorically to Christianity and the Christian church, have been publicly refuted by the establishment of the State of Israel. What is he talking about? Anybody know? You guys ever hear of deicide?
Oh, yeah. They killed Jesus.
Right. Every time a Jew is persecuted anywhere in the world, the Christians taught that this is their punishment for deicide.
And it was Jesus that killed them?
No, it was that because we are somehow responsible for the death of Jesus, therefore the Jew is to be eternally damned and scattered throughout the globe, you know, condemned, you know, punished, and then with the state of Israel, that like it just threw everything into. Now, by the way, just know Pope John Paul II, who was a great man, and he put an end to that church teaching. He was probably the closest of all of any pope to the Jewish community. He had friends that were Jews when he was younger, and he was just a very righteous person. And he was the first one to kind of put an end to that theological teaching. But I just learned what happened in medieval Europe because of that teaching, how many tens of thousands of Jews that were killed in pogroms because of this idea that we put Jesus to death and we were guilty of killing their God. And so the creation of the state of Israel, so even though, you know, it's not sort of believed by many Christians anymore, although some do, unfortunately, it just, the whole idea of the Jews coming back, the Christian church called themselves the New Israel. When we were kicked out of Israel, they replaced us. And they believed theologically that they are the New Israel. Well, if they are the New Israel, then what the heck are the Jews doing back in Israel, successfully defending themselves in the land of their forefathers? What do we do with that theologically? It threw 2,000 years of church teachings into disarray. Four, this is my favorite, because it deals with us. Fourth, the beloved is knocking in the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated youth. The era of self-concealment at the beginning of the 1940s resulted in great confusion among the Jewish masses, in particular among the Jewish youth. How do you refer to a period of time when something awful happens to Jews and God is silent? We call that Hester Panim. What's a Panim? They say like a Zisa Panim, right? It was sweet, right? Face. Hester means to hide. Whose name sounds like Hester? Esther. Because her name is hidden. She had to hide her identity. Right, what's the whole theme of the Purim story? Megillat Esther means to reveal the hidden. God is hidden. So God's face was hidden when? In the beginning of the 1940s. What happens when God's face is hidden? People get turned off to Judaism. Where's God? How's he letting his special people suffer like this? We don't understand it. And I don't pretend to understand it. But then, something happens. And all of a sudden, he says, buried hidden thoughts and paradoxical reflections emerge from the depths of the souls of even the most avowed assimilationists. And once a Jew begins to think and contemplate, once his sleep is disturbed, who knows where his thoughts will take him, what form of expression his doubts and queries will assume. You know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said this beautifully. He said, the future of the Jewish people is all based on pride. Because if you are a proud Jew, then you're going to study about your Judaism. If you're a little embarrassed about your Judaism, or if you think it's like a little nebby, or it's not so exciting, or it's not so compelling, then you're not going to... That's a philosophical term, nebby. It's like a Yiddish word for like losery. You're like a little of a loser. It's like a nebuch. He's a nebisha, a nebisha. There's some Yiddish words you can't really, like, they don't cap. But it's like one of those words. And, I mean, I think about this every time I watch a sitcom and it's written by a Jew or it's played by a Jew and it's making some part, it's fun of some Judaism. Because they don't, and I don't blame them, and there's some very good Jewish comics. Some of them are proud of their Judaism, most are not, because they weren't raised to be knowledgeable or to be proud. And you can't really, you know, what are you going to pursue in life? Something you're proud of? You're going to pursue something that's kind of like a nebbish thing for you? I hate to say it. It's kind of like if you watch any Woody Allen. It's like the Woody Allen kind of like self-deprecating Jewish person. And I'm like, yeah. Because there isn't that strength. You know what? What's the ultimate counter to the nebbish Jew? To the nebbish diaspora Jew?
Idea.
Israelis.
Israelis.
Just strong, handsome, proud Jews. Whether you're religious or not. But I'm just telling you, it's a different breed of Jewry. And And the Baal Tshuva movement, by the way, in earnest. Anybody know when the Baal Tshuva movement actually began in America? Is it really hot here, or is it just me?
When
Andrew, we started the Baal Tshuva movement.
25 years ago.
No, tell me what event in Jewish history started the Baal Tshuva movement. When did it actually start in earnest? Two Shlomos both lived here on the Upper West Side. I'm giving you my own idea. Who are the two Shlomos from the Upper West Side?
One is not alive, one still is.
Karbach?
Shlomo Karbach, thank you. And Shlomo Riska, my teacher, who lives in Israel. He should live and be well. He was the founding rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue, which was like the first outreach synagogue in the 60s. Okay, why? What happened in the 60s that spurred Jews, young Jews, coming back to their Judaism? Because when I drove my Rebbe, who passed away a number of years ago, Rabbi Yosef Weiss, he took over Rav Soloveitchik's, the Kashrut class for the rabbis. And I used to drive him around sometimes. He was very old school, long white beard from the old country. And he asked me, what are you doing? What's your internship? And I was running a beginner service in Queens, where I'm from. He says, what's a beginner service? And I said, it's young Jewish people don't have much of a background in Judaism, and they're coming on Saturdays to learn more about Judaism. He looked at me. He was a brilliant scholar. He didn't understand what I was saying, so I repeated it. He didn't get it. His generation, they didn't... the idea of... The people who were religious were the Orthodox Jews raised in Orthodoxy, and everybody else wasn't. Mm-hmm. That changed in the 60s. What event, guys?
Six-Day War.
Mm-hmm. What happened in the Six-Day War? That inspired people to want to look into their Judaism. Pride. Jews started more than in 48, even. Because they were digging graves in Tel Aviv. They were expecting such a catastrophe. And it was such an incredible success. Israel tripled its size and took back the old city of Jerusalem. And it was like one big Am Yisrael Chai thing. And it just changed Jewish history. And people just wanted to look into Judaism now. That happened also the Bar Kokhba Revolt. You know how many non-Jews were converting to Judaism during the Bar Kokhba Revolt over 2,000 years ago? Because it was potentially a very successful revolt. So anyway, number four is what happens when great things happen to Jewish people and people start getting a little Jewish pride, start questioning, start thinking, maybe I shouldn't chuck this so quickly. Maybe there's something to this. Now, we shouldn't judge our own religious development based on what happens. That means after October 7th, we should just chuck our religious observance. No, we should up our religious observance. But it's very hard, and you need a lot of faith to keep Shabbos and do all these things when Jews are suffering. It's very difficult. When everything is going great, you know, and it's that way in our own personal lives. You get the promotion, the girl says, yeah, whatever it is that's going great in your life, it's like easier to be a religious Jew, you know, and it's harder when things aren't going your way. So Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, like, come on, God has given you such a knock on the door here. Even the young people who are so turned off to Judaism are now starting to wonder, like, wait, maybe this is worth looking into. Look at, yeah.
So Rabbi Pearl, you know Rabbi Pearl.
Pearl?
Yeah, from the Chabad of the Yom.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So he says the exact opposite, that it's much easier to be religious when things are going very tough because it's...
No atheists in foxholes?
Yeah, pretty much. And that it is the... He says that this generation of Americans, that the big struggle that we face is affluence. That's the way that...
Is the what? Say again?
Affluence, which... takes from spirituality,
takes
from the ability to really see God.
Yeah, I understand that. Alan Dershowitz said that to me once. I interviewed him, and he said, a little anti-Semitism is always good for your business, for your work.
That's
what he said.
For your work.
For my work.
Yeah.
Too much. He says, a little anti-Semitism will be good for your work.
I agree. I mean, I hate to say it.
So, I hear you. But it's very hard, I have to tell you. I don't like that. I don't like that, like, oh, I need God now. I think we should believe and we should be, because, like, this is filling us with something positive. Mm-hmm. That's the future of Judaism and the Jewish people. It's not negativity, it's not persecution. But I understand sociologically there is a certain reality to that. You know, we actually produced more Torah scholarship. And there were more Jews that were religious and observant when we lived in oppression and persecution. than when we do worse in affluence and prosperity, actually. It shouldn't have to be that way,
yeah.
But that's there is a certain reality to that, and that's a good point. All right, so you... all right, look at number five. The fifth knock of the beloved... Just contradicted everything I just said. That's fine. Okay, I'll take it.
You win.
You do. The fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. For the first time in the history of our exile, divine providence surprised our enemies with the sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking. It's not hefker. What's the word hefker? Hefker is, we use that word, I don't expect you to remember this. What did you do after you searched for your chametz on the night before the Seder? You did what's called a bittul. Before the burning, what's a bittul? You nullify. You say it's hefker. It's ownerless like the dust of the world. So if I take this tape recorder and I say, I'm relinquishing my ownership, and then Nava picks it up, it's yours now. You're not stealing. What does he mean by hefker? Jewish blood is not hefker.
It's not someone's property.
What happened in Europe if you beat up on a Jew?
The Jews belong to something somewhere. It's not just like you can just take them away from.
There was presence. No recourse. A Jew got beaten up in a street in Europe in the 40s. Who are you going to go to? Who are you going to call? You're going to call the police. The police are part of the. You're going to call. There was no. Now I hate to say it, and we can get into a long discussion. And I don't want to get so cynical. You know, and we always thought America was going to be different. I had a million panels in the hotel about this over Passover.
Right.
You know, we always thought America was the exception. There would always be somebody to talk to about that here. Okay? And I give a huge pat on the back to the mayor, because the universities did not shut down some of these violent protests. But the NYPD came in Columbia's case, and shut it down. So, but what happens when that... What happens if we don't have such a wonderful mayor? In this regard, I'm saying it's perfect. Talk to Moshe if you have issues. Overall, I happen to be a big fan of his, of the mayor. He's a person of great integrity. But what happens if he's replaced by someone who's coming out of Columbia? He was a professor at Columbia, and. A woman in my building, she came into, we were in the elevator, I had to make small elevator talk. I said, how are you? She's like, eh. She saw my yarmulke. She goes, I said, what do you do? She goes, I teach in the new school. So I said, I'm like, how's that going? She goes, it's not good there. And then my thing opened and I left. You know, and she said, yeah, the school didn't do anything and we're waiting for the police to keep it calm, and it was not calm. And it's just like very unpleasant for me to work there. And to teach there. So what happens if that just keeps developing? And at some point, people stop pushing back. I mean, that can happen, no? It's not so unrealistic.
That's how Maritza was saying, like, when you tell a lie and you say it enough, it goes unopposed, it becomes fact.
True.
So it's like someone trying to, like, you know, promote a movement, like what, you know, these... people are doing on college campuses, if it goes unopposed, then it becomes mainstream, you know, where it's accepted.
It's
so,
gotten mainstream, kind of.
It's become somewhat mainstream, but it's not everywhere. I think I've gotten a lot, I mean, this is totally anecdotal, but there isn't a day that goes by that somebody doesn't walk over to me. Okay, I was wearing my MGE t-shirt that we marched in the parade with on Sunday. I was running in the park, and... you know, I had that and this, you know, so I'm like, come talk to me, you know, and people say the nicest things. I've had a lot of them in the last couple of weeks. I don't think they make a lot of noise. I think there's probably a lot of people that are just, you know, but there are a lot of people on the other side of this thing too, and it's quite disturbing. And the question is, what's the recourse? What is the recourse? Is there a recourse anywhere outside of Israel? And you say, oh, you know, were you guys here on Shabbat? We had the colonel.
Yes.
He was unbelievable.
Yeah. You're a pin drop.
Yeah, he was unbelievable. Yeah. By the way, you should come to Shabbat. We're having Daniela Simons. I watched Daniela grow up from a little girl. I'm friends with her parents. She served in the IDF. She's in Colombia now, and she's a named plaintiff.
in a lawsuit against Columbia. She's speaking on Shabbat morning. You should come and hear her story. She's amazing. And so he was saying, like, you know, is Israel really independent? Like, how much does Israel continue to rely on the United States? Like, Biden is threatening now not to continue to give weapons to Israel if they continue with the war. What's Israel supposed to do? Let Hamas stay? At what point is America going to let Israel finish off Hamas? And if you don't finish off Hamas, this is the fourth time this has happened. If Israel doesn't finish off Hamas, this is going to happen again. So what do? You diss your most important ally? I don't know. I'm not saying I have an answer. But I do know that at least in Israel, you can fight back. And there is that kind of spirit in Israel that we're going to do what we have to do to protect ourselves, and we're going to keep taking out, you know, Iranian nuclear scientists, you know, as they get closer and closer to take another guy out. Ooh, I don't know how he died. You know, that's been going on for years. I don't know if anybody wants to share anything. It's like, it's a crazy...
That's the conversation we had.
I remember Malcolm Holmline. Anybody know who Malcolm Holmline is? He was the executive vice president of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, the longest title of any organization in the world. It's the umbrella group for all the Jewish organizations in the United States. And he spoke at my mother's yard site lecture 20 years ago. My mother passed away 28 years ago. He spoke like 20 years ago, and he spoke about Iran. And I was like, what is he talking about? Who's Iran? They were like in the Megillah story. That's the only thing I know about Iranians and Persians, is they tried to kill us like 2,000 years ago. Why is he talking about Iran 20 years ago? He spent the whole time talking about Iran, the Iranian threat. I'm like, what's he talking about? You know, and it's been going on a long time, you know?
Yeah.
Let's take the sixth knock, which we must not ignore, was heard when the gates of the land were opened. A Jew who flees from a hostile country now knows he can find a secure refuge in the land of his ancestors. Now that the era of divine self-concealment is over, Jews have been uprooted from their homes, can find lodging in the Holy Land. I hope, I'd like to believe Rabbi Soloveitchik would still write that even after October 7th. Because what the lieutenant colonel said, Conriques, that's his name, he's half Swedish, Conriques, said that this is the first time since the founding of the State of Israel that Jews have been kicked out of their homes. The Jews have been evicted from their homes. 65,000 Jews from the north are not living in their homes for 6 months. And there's no end in sight. Unless Hezbollah is pushed back significantly or taken out of commission. And he said they're five times as powerful as Hamas. And they're not going home. So it's like a very, you know, he started his speech by saying, this will not be an Am Yisrael Chai speech. Even though I asked him not to start his speech that way, because he started his speech in the hotel that way. And I'm like, I think they need a little more inspiration than the people in the hotel. So try to keep it a little positive. He's a military guy. He just says it like, you know.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, is this all this being called into question? No, you speak to anyone who survived the Holocaust and they'll say, we have a government, we have an army, you know, and that's not something to take for granted. Has anyone been to the Nova exhibit downtown?
I did in Israel.
I was thinking, if there's a night next week, there's anybody free, it's not, you don't have to go, but I thought, if anybody wants to go, let me know. I was thinking of it maybe going next Monday, not Monday, it's Yom HaTzimut, maybe
going
Tuesday.
Where
are you going?
The 20th.
Yeah? When's the 20th? What is it?
The following Monday.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So maybe we'll go.
Through the end of the month.
Yeah, so maybe we'll...
I would do that. I can...
Do you want to do that? Yeah. The following Monday?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should work with
it. Maybe we'll... Anyone who wants to come, whatever. Yeah, I heard it's done very well.
Otherwise, when you just go, you have to RSVP.
You have to get tickets.
I think you have to get tickets.
They're $1.
It's like $3.
Yeah. It is dollars. But they also said that, like, if you bring someone that's not Jewish to it, makes a bigger impact.
Make sure what?
To, like, spread to your non-Jewish friends.
Right, to friends.
Like, yeah, because that's when you
They don't
want
to just
awareness.
Preach to the choir.
Yeah.
Right. Correct. So, I want to leave you on a high note. We're definitely in a very challenging moment in Jewish history, in, you know, post-Israel history. But according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, these were knocks. And we all have the opportunity to be really involved. So when we go crazy about Israel, it's not just because Tel Aviv is a very cool city to live in. And it's not just because Jerusalem is such a holy city to live in. You know, and the wall, and Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and all of that. And it's also because it's part of a sort of reunion between God and the people of Israel. There was a big breakup, if you didn't hear about the breakup. So the breakup, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, was the Holocaust. Or it was an expression of the breakup. It's a 2,000-year-long breakup. And the way these rabbis view is that we're getting back together. We're getting back together with Hashem. And that, if you want to be part of that, like, who doesn't want to be part of that? That's a very beautiful way of looking at religious Zionism. Not just the Zionism. What's Zionism? Theodor Herzl's Zionism is amazing. Safe haven. But that's all it is. It's just a place to go to be safe.
Yeah.
Religious Zionism is getting back in with Hashem. Because Israel is such an important part of our relationship with God. It's not ancillary to our relationship. It's just about the Torah. Do you know how many mitzvot revolve around Israel? What's called in Hebrew, mitzvot hatzliot ba'aretz. How many mitzvot revolve, and how central the temple was and the Sanhedrin and everything. Israel is just like it's the center of what Jewish life is supposed to be. We got so used to being in the diaspora for so long, we don't really see it that way. But anything that happens in Israel is important if you have a little sense of the Jewish religion, Jewish faith. So I'm a big Zionist, not simply because we need a safe haven. And by the way, a few people were saying this. I just interviewed Michael Oren. Do you guys know Michael Oren?
Mm-hmm.
Michael Oren wrote the book. He wrote 11 books. He's awesome. He spoke here a few times. We had a little in with him because his son used to come to MJE. And he's a friend, and I just did a podcast interview with him. And he said for a lot of secular Zionists, what happened on October 7th was really, really riveting. Because secular Zionism is just it's a safe haven. It's a place you go to be safe from your Gentile enemies. And that was really...
That scared me.
Yeah, well, somebody had to get up. October 7th was a... was kind of like... It's not entirely safe. You know, it's not entirely safe. But if you're a religious Zionist, then Israel means more than a safe haven, and that all still applies.
So
we are still getting back together with God. Yeah.
Like in the Haggadah, when it says, like, next year in Jerusalem, I'm, like, curious, because we haven't really had the land of Israel for a long time, will they ever update it and be like, because we are in Jerusalem.
Oh, so you know what we say? What do Jews in Israel say when they're on the Pesach say? Anybody in Israel for Pesach?
No.
What did you say in Seder?
What did you say?
L'shanaim habnuya. L'shana habab Yerushalayim habnuya. Habnuya means rebuilt. Rebuilt means like post-Mashiach.
Like rebuilt the temple?
Rebuilt the temple, exactly. Yeah. That's what Jews in Israel do.
A question.
Yeah.
So why did Soloveitchik support giving up land?
He did not view land as the greatest value in Judaism. He viewed life as a greater value than land. So if it could be argued reasonably that giving back land could save Jewish lives, he was in favor of it. But it has to be, you have to really believe that. Unfortunately, very few people believe that anymore. But at the time when he wrote it, they had just started this whole land peace negotiations. And people were very optimistic because didn't we make peace with Jordan and Egypt that way? We certainly did. We made peace with two enemies. And those peace treaties have held. They're still terribly anti-Semitic countries, particularly Egypt. But we haven't had any wars with Egypt and Jordan. And Israel's relationship with Jordan is quite good. It's not like the Abraham Accords, by the way. Those relationships with the Sunni states, Arab states, are really amazing. There's like real cultural exchanges. It goes much deeper than the So that was the theory. The theory was, like, if we give up some land, well, anybody know what we gave up to get a peace treaty with Egypt?
Sinai.
We gave up the Sinai Peninsula. What's that? No, they were playing around with that. All right, we tried giving up the Gaza Strip for peace with Palestinians. That didn't seem to work. That completely backfired. And by the way, I was in Israel that summer during the disengagement, and our tour guide, who was a military expert, welcome, Jack. Our tour guide, who was a military expert, was in favor of the disengagement. Religious guy. He thought it was a great idea.
Mm-mm.
Because he said, not because it's going to make better peace with our Arab neighbors. He said it's about 7,500 Jews surrounded by a million Arabs. It's not a good use of the IDF's limited, abilities. And just give it back. It may not even be considered biblical Israel according to some definitions. And we'll give them a little something, and turned into a huge, huge mistake. You know, hindsight is whatever that expression is, But that's why he was in favor. We're talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach to religious Zionism allowed for the giving back of land. And it was very controversial when he said his son-in-law, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, of blessed memory, took up basically the same position as his father-in-law. And he got himself into a lot of hot water with his own congregants, because most Orthodox Jews were very cynical and skeptical about the prospect of peace by giving up land.
So they just disagreed politically,
It was really a political disagreement, not a religious one. But the difference of opinion between, let's say, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook, or Lubavitch Rebbe, was a religious one. Because Lubavitch Rebbe did not believe that even to save a life, you're allowed to give up land in Israel. Any other questions or comments? I just want to mention one thing. It has nothing to do with our discussion tonight, but I forgot to talk to you about it. And I'm going to feel really guilty if I leave tonight without discussing it, just for 2 minutes. We're counting the Omer.
Yes, I was going
to
say
we didn't get to talk about it before Passover started. Because when did we start actually counting the Omer?
Tuesday.
The second night of Passover.
Mm-hmm.
What is the deal? What are we counting?
Teshuvah.
We're counting all the way from holiday of... Anybody know why? Why? What is this counting? What's the
40
idea?
40 days.
We count how many days?
40 days.
49 days. They were actually from what event to what event were there 49 days?
God sending us out of Egypt to them receiving the Torah.
Yeah, they were actually just 49 days. And what is the theme? What's the feel of that count? Because we were literally taken out of Egypt. What kind of spiritual level were we on when we left Egypt? Very low.
Mm-hmm.
We were on, according to the Kabbalists, the 49th level of ritual impurity. So much so that if we had sunk one more notch, one more rung, 50th was like no turning back. That's why it says that God took us out of Egypt in a haste. He had to get us out right then and there. And then every day was one level. And we don't just count, that's what they went through. That's what we go through. We leave Egypt. That's what our Seder's were for. That's what Passover is for. And then every day we count another, right, to get closer and closer until we what? What are we doing on Shavuos in a couple of weeks? We're going to learn Torah. We're going to celebrate the Torah. We're going to re-accept the Torah back into our lives. And that's a very positive, joyous counting. Now, what also happened during this period of time on the Jewish calendar that makes
Rabbi
it...
Rabbi Akiva students.
Right, so later on, that's not in the Torah, the Rabbi Akiva students. What I just described to you is in the Torah, Svartam Lachem, Bimacharat HaShabbat, the Torah says, and you will count from the day after the holiday begins. That's biblical, and that's joyous, because you're counting up. I'll tell you quickly the Midrash, famous Midrash, of a king walking with his servants, and they hear somebody who fell in a ditch, and the king orders his men to see what's going on, and they see, lo and behold, some guy's in a terrible ditch, he can't get up, so the king yells down, not only am I going to have my men pick you up from the ditch, I'm going to bring you back to the palace, and you're going to marry my daughter, the princess. And the guy's like, just get me out of the ditch.
Yeah.
They pull him out of the ditch, just as the Midrash. They pull him out of the ditch, and what does he start to do?
Run away. Come to your man.
He starts counting. What is he counting? He came through on the first promise. I didn't say it right. He brings him back to the palace, and then he starts counting to the day of his wedding. Because the king came through on the first two promises, pulling him out, bringing him to the palace. He also said he was going to marry the princess. That's what the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai was. It's the proverbial marriage between the Jewish people and God. Right? The mountain was supposed to be like the ring, where the Torah is the ring, and the mountain is like the chuppah, like all these metaphors. So that's what we're doing. It's a very joyous counting up and up, spiritually elevating ourselves. But at some period in history during the Roman era, this great rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, lost all of his students during this same period of time. And therefore it becomes of a quasi-mourning period. People don't get haircuts, some people don't shave, go to live music concerts during this period of time in order to commemorate the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. So it's a very weird period, because on one hand the counting is quite joyous, because you're counting up spiritually, getting closer to getting the Torah. On the other hand, you're following certain mourning practices because we're commemorating the death of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, who died, the rabbis say, Shalom Negu Kavod Zelazet. They didn't show proper respect one to the next. I just wanted to throw that out. Any questions just about the Omer? So if you should try to count every night. If you miss a day, keep counting, just count without a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why do they count strangely? It's not like today is...
Right.
16,
right. We're gonna do it right now.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Jack, can you do me a favor?
It's a new day.
Just grab me a prayer book from literally right outside this room. There's a table.
Outside.
Oh, there. That's fine. Perfect. Oh. Thank you. We'll do this together. So, because the Torah mentions weeks and days. So when you count, you have to mention. Thank you so much. Everybody know, almost to be Rabbi Jack Hartstein, standing here.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, welcome to MGE.
Whenever I pass over the GW Bridge, I always think about which level I'm taking.
That was great. See, you remember your talk.
I'm like, I'm taking the lower level.
You're going to get a little break, and then Rabbi Jack's going to give you guys a great class on AI. But let's do the let's count the Omer together. If you haven't been saying it with a blessing, you haven't been saying it every night. Just answer Amen to my blessing, and then we'll do the count together. Okay, let's do that. It's a new night. Is that cool? Mm-hmm. You ready?
Yeah.
Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Asher Kedushanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer Hayom Shisha Asar Yom Shehem Shnei Shavuot Ushnei Yamim Ba'Omer. Which means today is 16 days, which are 2 weeks and 2 days of the Omer. If you're really into Kabbalah, my son does this every night. Each day of the Omer is like a different configuration of the different Sfirot, which are the divine emanations that God used to create the world, and how they combine with each other to create different energy forces that we're supposed to be picking up on and using to elevate ourselves. I don't have time to discuss that right now. But if you're interested, there are some prayer books that have, like, which sphera is it that's combining which whatever sphera. It's pretty cool. Awesome stuff. So anyway, it should be a good 16th of the day.
Do you have to say the other part of the book?
Yeah, there's a little prayer at the end. I was not satisfied with what I did. Yes, okay, I'll do it. Harachaman hu yachzir lanu. May God return for us avodat beit hamikdash limkoma, the service of the temple to its place, b'mehera v'yameinu, speedily in our days, amen, selah. Awesome. Guys, take a 5-minute break, and then come back for Rabbi Jack. And hopefully we'll see you guys over Shabbat.
Shabbat, and then also the...
Oh, there is a lunch, by the way. There's also a lunch.
And a dinner.
There's a dinner Friday night. We still have spots for the dinner. Jill and I are going to be here for the dinner with the rest of the MJ staff. And that's going to be beautiful. And
also,
we're having a lunch on Saturday morning. Yes, also, forgot. Next Shabbat, we're going to Rabbi Moshe Weinberger's shul.
Oh, yeah.
You want to come with us?
For the Shabbat.
He's awesome. And this time, he's actually going to be there. Last time we went, he wasn't there. It's a beautiful, we're being put up by some really lovely families in Woodmere. And we just booked another really special rabbinic figure in the neighborhood that's going to be talking to our group. It's going to be a beautiful Shabbos, so anybody wants to come, thank you. Remind me, I didn't do my announcements. I'm glad I have these announcements in.
No, unfortunately, I'm
but she's trying to change her plans.